Good morning, everybody. Morning in this room, morning next door in the communion room, morning online. If that's where you are, we're really glad. So as you just heard in the video, make sure that you grab the QR code and jump into some of the stuff that's just fixing to start as we sort of get the airplane boarded and start taking off for the spring semester. I want you to be a part of it and not miss that. Ushers, would you bring some Bibles forward? We're gonna look at chapter 20 in the Gospel of John. And if you need a Bible to borrow or to keep, they're bringing them down for you. If you have your own or you're gonna use technology, that's great as well. John 20 is where we're going. And the question that we're gonna deal with today as we continue this series that we started last week, asking for a friend, is what do I do with my doubts? What do I do with my doubts about faith? Now, I want to start by saying I'm really focused on three groups of people, okay? Yes, if you're here or listening and you're a doubter because you never believed, maybe because you think faith is sort of a goofy, wispy thing, well, I hope that what we talk about can be helpful. Secondly, some of you who say, well, I am a believer, but I still have my doubts. I'm sort of like the man in the Gospel of Mark who said, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. Well, maybe today can be helpful. I hope so. Thirdly, there's any number of you who say, oh, I'm a believer. So I don't ever have any doubt. And I never have. You're actually the group I'm the most concerned about, and I'm going to tell you why. I've known too many people over the years who were raised in the church, took the faith of their mom or their dad, and then, because it had never been tried or tested, when they get in their 20s or their 30s and life gets hard, and they've never really grappled with why do I believe what I believe, something happens and their faith sort of crumbles. It just can't stand the weight of what's going on in their life. And what I really want to do is try to help you to realize there is more than just feelings about faith. There's actually a strong skeletal foundation that, as Jesus said, let's love the Lord with all of our heart, our soul, and our mind, we can use. Okay, so those are the three groups of people that I sort of have in mind. Now, whenever I think of doubters, I always think of a friend. I've told you about him before, named Frank. He started coming to our church years ago, back in the early days of our church. And somewhat early on, he pulled me aside and he said, now, Pastor Ken, I just need to tell you something. I'm here because of my wife. And I don't believe all this stuff, pointing to my Bible. He said, I don't believe all that stuff. Walking on water, miracles, and resurrection. I don't believe in that stuff. My wife, she believes that, but I don't believe that. I just want to go on record saying I don't believe that so that nobody can say I'm a hypocrite by being here. I said, well, great. I appreciate your honesty, and I hope that you just keep on coming and listening and bring any questions that you have. I'd love to talk with you about it. Perhaps my fondness to Frank is tied to a character in the Bible that we're going to look at here in John chapter 20, who, if there was ever a patron saint of doubters, it would be this man. His name was Thomas. He's known as Doubting Thomas. Now, before we read the story of Doubting Thomas, let's just remember what the context was, because it's always important to remember what's going on when this happens, the part that we're reading. Jesus has been raised to life. It's the first Easter. He's been alive since early that morning, and now it's nighttime. And he's just made his first appearance with the disciples in the upper room, presumably. And he's shown himself to the 12. Well, minus Judas, who's taken his own life, minus Thomas. Why no Thomas? We don't know that. But let's just start reading in chapter 20, verse 24. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So, sometime later, the other disciples told Thomas, we've seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hand and put my fingers in the nails where the nails were and put my hand to his side, I will not believe. And I believe this surface is the first of three things I want you to jot down today, okay? So if you're a note taker, here's the first of three things I want you to take when it comes to what do we do with our doubts? First thing, admit your doubts. That's what Thomas does. He tells his friends plainly, unless I see him with my own eyes, count me out. I don't believe. He wasn't going to pretend. He wasn't going to go along to get along. He was a skeptic, and he was honest about it. Now, notice, Thomas was a skeptic, but he wasn't a cynic. And there is a difference, you realize. Skeptics ask real questions. Cynics assume the answers. Skeptics say, I don't believe that could be true, but I'll investigate it. Cynics say, that couldn't possibly be true. And that's stupid, and I wouldn't even bother investigating it. I'm going to ridicule it. Skeptics are intellectually honest and searching for truth. Cynics hide behind sarcastic jabs rather than engaging their minds. So if you're a doubter, I do wonder this. Are you a skeptic or are you a cynic? Thomas was a skeptic in his doubt. But he wasn't a cynic. And we know that because of where we find him the very next Sunday night. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. He's back with the disciples. Why? I suspect because he surely figured, if what you all have told me is true, I'm sure he's going to come on back again, and he's going to show himself to us again. And so I'm staying in this time. I'm staying close to the pack. I'm staying with you boys. I'm not going to venture off by myself. I don't want to miss it a second time. He wasn't yet a believer, but he kept showing up. And some of you, that's why you're here. You don't exactly believe yet, but you're at least somewhat convinced that many of us do. And so you keep coming and you keep showing up and just because maybe in case one day all the dots kind of get connected in your soul and it clicks. And I love that. If that's how it is that you're here, you are welcome, welcome, welcome. And I hope, like my friend Frank, you just keep on coming. But after you admit your doubts, you got to go a step further. You owe it to yourself to do a second thing. Jot this one down. You got to investigate. You got to investigate the evidence. Thomas, he didn't give up. He kept showing up instead. And 1 week later, on that first Sunday after Easter, look what happened. Verse 26, though the doors were locked, Jesus came and he stood among them and he said, peace be with you. And then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe, he told Thomas. Jesus knew what Thomas had said he would need to believe. You almost get the sense that maybe Jesus had been in the room listening even when the rest couldn't see him in that moment. But notice what Jesus didn't say. Thomas, you dummy. Why couldn't you just believed? He didn't do that. He welcomed the scrutiny. And I think that's significant. He said, I know what you want, Thomas, so go ahead. You can touch. You can just put your hands right where the holes were, right where the spear went in the side. You can investigate it for yourself. He welcomed Thomas's investigation, and he welcomes yours as well. He walks towards your questions, not away from them. And this is why throughout history, men and women with the sharpest of minds have stepped into that invitation to investigation. And I'll tell you about one such thinker. He was a 17th century mathematician and philosopher. His name was Blaise Pascal. And if you're a mathematician or a scientist, yes, I'm talking about that Pascal, as in Pascal's law or Pascal's triangle. His mother died when he was young, and so his father took responsibility to homeschool Blaise Pascal. But he could tell what a bright young boy he had, and he realized there is one subject with it, which if he starts to figure this out, he'll stay up all night, and it'll just go off the rails. And so at that, he locked the math books up in the closet at night. You've probably had to do that with your children about homework as well, right? And but even with the math books locked up at the age of 12, Blaise Pascal, on his own, had figured out Euclidean geometry. Now, what many people don't know about Blaise Pascal is that he actually had a very powerful encounter with God when he was 31. It's referred to as the night of fire. Fire, he wrote. Whatever happened that night between him and God, it was a profound experience. And though he didn't talk a great deal about it, it was always a thing that he held very reverently. In fact, he wrote a little commemorative about it on a piece of cloth, and he sewed it into the inside of his coat so that he could wear it next to his heart. And then when he would change coats, he would unstitch it and he'd sew it into the next coat just to remember that night of fire. And after that night, when he'd encountered God in a powerful way at age 31, he said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to use the best of my brilliant mind to make a most coherent, sensible case for faith. The only problem was the rest of his life would only be 8 more years. He would die at 39. But he'd made a lot of notes, and though he couldn't finish the book, it still has been gathered and put together, and it's called the Pensée. And you can buy it. It's actually a very best-selling book over the years. Now, what you need to understand about France, Paris, in the 1600s is the Shakers and the Movers were not the rich, the famous, the movie stars, the musicians, the athletes. No, the Shakers and the Movers. If you wanted to have a happening party, you invited the scientists and the mathematicians. That must have been a party. And so if that's you, you just lean over to your spouse and say, I told you, I'm cool. I always knew it. You know, I just came in the wrong generation. All right. And so these were Pascal's people. This were his tribe. And he knew two things about his mathematician and scientific-minded friends. He knew they loved to party and they loved to gamble at the horse racing track. He knew those two things. And so this is going to guide him in an exercise using what is called the expectation formula. And I want to explain it to you just using simplistic terms, and you can just look at the visual as it goes up. But basically what he was saying is if you take your odds of winning and you multiply it times your payoff, you subtract the cost to place the bet, this will give you a number, and that's your expectation variable. The higher the number, the smarter the bet. Okay, so let's just illustrate. Row one, horse A. Row two, horse B. Now let's say for the sake of argument, these horses run against each other 10 times. 5 of the times, horse A is gonna win. 5 of the time, horse B is gonna win. So what are your odds? 50%. It's a 50-50. Okay, and so he would say, now drop that in here. Now, let's talk about payoff. Suppose you know if horse A wins, you're going to get $200, and if horse B wins, you're going to get $100. And then let's talk about the cost, okay? What's it going to cost to place that bet? We're going to say $10. Now, I realize these numbers are ridiculous, all right? They're just exaggerating to make the math easy to follow. Now, do the math, okay? Let's do the math on horse A. If you have 50% and you multiply it times 200, you're at 100, subtract your $10 cost, and your expectation value variable is 90, okay? Right, now horse B, let's do the same math, 50% times 100 minus the cost, and you have an expectation variable of 40. Which horse are you gonna place your bet on? Say it. Yeah, horse A. Of course, you're doing the math. And Pascal was like, here's how my friends place their bets. Now, using the same frame of thinking, he said, let's try it this way. Same chart, same concept. Let's build in horse A, we'll call atheism. Okay, no God. What are the odds of that? Even his most skeptical of friends would have to be able to admit, well, I can't say 100, I can't disprove God beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I really, 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 really think I'm right as an atheist, so 99%. Pascal's like, okay, you take 99, I'll take one. 99%, okay? Now, if you're right, atheist, he said, what'll your payoff be? Well, whatever measurable pleasures in this life that you get, whatever you go for and you get and you achieve and you feel and you want and you have, and that's your payoff, because there's nothing else after that. And so you have some payoff, it's just a finite payoff. Whatever you accumulate, whatever you wanted, that's your payoff, a finite payoff. Now, what's the cost? What's the cost of becoming an atheist? Well, there's not really much cost. I mean, you don't have to go to church, you don't have to get baptized, you don't have to go to Bible study, you don't have to give money away to, if you want to be dishonest, you can be dishonest. If you want to be mean, you can be mean, you know? So it doesn't really cost you much to be an atheist, right? So there's very small cost, none really, to speak of. Now, if you take a non-zero probability and a finite payoff and you subtract a very small cost, what do you have? You have a finite expectation variable. Now, go to the second row and let's go for the argument for God. Yes, God, all right? What's the probability? Pascal said, I gave you the 99, I'll take the one, all right? And so on this row, 1% chance I win. So you're saying there's a chance, okay? And what's the payoff? What's the payoff gonna be? It's not an amount of dollars. Oh no, the payoff's far more and better than that. If I'm right, I get heaven. I get eternal life. I get to be with my creator. I win it all if I'm right. Now, what's the cost of believing? Well, there is some cost. I mean, sometimes I don't want to forgive people who hurt my feelings. Sometimes I don't want to give money away to the poor people, you know. But, you know, he said they got to do it. So, you know, there's a little bit of a cost, all right? But it's a finite cost, right? Now, do the math. You take any non-zero probability and a mere 1%, you multiply it by infinity and you subtract some finite cost, and you still get an infinite variable. And so, with this, Pascal said, you're already using this formula when you place your bets at the horse track. Why wouldn't you use it for something that matters so much more than a bet at the horse racing track? This can affect your whole eternity. Why wouldn't you use the same logic? It's called Pascal's wager. You can Google it if you want to understand more about it. But basically what it says is, Pascal was saying, look, the unbeliever, if he is right, can never have the satisfaction of knowing, I was right, because he's dead and there was nothing. He was right. But if he's wrong, he will face the consequences of learning, uh-oh, I was wrong. And so basically, unbelief gives you a no satisfaction guarantee. You lose no matter what. On the other hand, he said, the believer, if he's right, he will have the satisfaction of finding out, I was right. I have everlasting life. I'm with the Lord. But if he's wrong, for some reason, you know, all this really was mumbo jumbo. And he's like, well, he'll never have to face the consequences of knowing he was wrong, because there was nothing and that was the end. So belief gives you a no dissatisfaction guarantee. See how it works? And so this is what Blaise Pascal would do, which doesn't prove anything about Jesus, but it would at least get his mathematical and scientific friends onto the playing field of using their mind and saying, okay, well, maybe I would be open to the argument of theism. All right, now before I tell you the next thing that Pascal would do, I wanna go back and let's just remember, what are we talking about with Thomas? Thomas didn't walk away during his season of doubt. He kept showing up. And then the Lord showed up and he let him personally touch. And then what happened? Verse 28. Thomas said, my Lord and my God. He connected the dots. He followed the thread. He was able to form a conclusion. And I think that's a good third thing for you to jot down. After you admit your doubts, investigate the evidence, you got to follow the thread to your own conclusion using your mind. Now, at some point, sometimes skeptics object here and say, okay, well, I'm going to challenge the premise of the argument because we're talking about this guy Thomas and his understanding of the resurrection, his experience of the resurrection. But how do we know that all of that isn't just a made-up story? We'll talk more about that next week. But how do we know that this wasn't just a made-up story that some of the disciples came along later and they're like, oh, this is such a sad tale. He got crucified and he got buried. And I got an idea. Let's have a happy ending. We'll make him rise from the dead. That sounds pretty good. How do we know that that didn't happen? It is a fair question. Well, one thing you have to deal with is the reality that countless early original Christians died for their faith. That's not just biblical history. That's secular history. The Christians who were persecuted and martyred for their faith after saying, oh, we've seen him. We've talked to him. We've touched him. We ate with him. And then when the authorities and the Roman government began to come down upon them and say, we're going to kill you unless you change your story. They're like, that's okay. You can kill us because we've seen him and we know we're going to be with him just as he has been raised from the dead, so shall we. All right? So you have to deal with this historical reality that's non-controverted, that there were martyrs, many of them. So what can we say about the resurrection, particularly regarding the people who were perpetuating their belief in this resurrection? Only one of three things can be the case. Either those believers were deceived, or they were deceivers, or they were right, they were accurate. They were telling the truth. So let's just stand in those circles for a minute. Okay, let's suppose that they were deceived. Maybe grief was playing a trick on their minds, and maybe they were just imagining, oh, there's a guy, he looks kind of like Jesus. I think he's alive, you know. And so they just missed it, you know, and they were mistaken about that. So there was this philosopher called Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now, Wittgenstein was no Christian at all. But as he philosophized about the concept of a mistake, he did notice this and observe this and state, a mistake does have parameters. So if you're going to call something a mistake, it has to fit inside mistake-worthy parameters. Let me illustrate. Suppose I was driving down Louetta and I see a Hyundai Santa Fe that looks like my wife's, Suzanne's car. And I was like, there's Suzanne. So I speed up and I go up beside her and I'm fixing a wave and I look in and there's a grizzly bearded man who looks like he stepped out of the Old Testament. I'm like, whoa, that's not Suzanne. Now, that's a makeable mistake. Well, it's the same color car, same model car, should have looked at the license plate to notice, you know, and it's embarrassing. Okay, but that's a makeable mistake, right? Wittgenstein would say, yeah, that falls within the parameters of a makeable mistake. But on the other hand, if I came in here and said, I just saw my wife, Suzanne. She was riding down Louetta on a 15-foot giraffe. That's not a makeable mistake. Either you would know, you're messing around, you're kidding. Or we need to call the little white men, the little men in the little white coats and say, da-da-da, you know, something's gone wrong with Ken. He's seeing things. That's not a makeable, that falls outside of the parameters of a makeable mistake, okay? And so let's apply this now to resurrection, okay? If one person, maybe two people, even three, in the aftermath of the crucifixion are like, we saw the risen Christ. We did. It's like one, two, maybe three people. And, you know, we'll say they were grief-stricken and maybe they were looking from a distance and they really believed it. They believed, I know that was Jesus. I just know it was. Well, that could fall within the parameters of a makeable mistake. On the other hand, if you look at 1 Corinthians 15, it's not just one or two or three people who saw him. Paul says, no, 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 here's the thing about it. He appeared to Peter and then to James and then to the 12 and then to some 500. You read this in 1 Corinthians 15, at least 500 people. And Paul said, oh, and many of them are alive. You can go talk to them. You can interview them yourself. You can check the evidence out yourself. And plus, not only did they see him, but they talked with him and they touched him. Thomas did. Mary Magdalene had already hugged his legs at the resurrection. They ate with him, fish. And that, I mean, that falls outside the parameters of a makeable mistake. So you say, okay, then they must not have been deceived, but maybe they were deceivers. That's it. Back to that whole concept of we're going to finish this story. We're going to write a happy ending to it. And everybody lived happily ever after. And he's alive. And they said, now, nobody ever is going to tell the truth. We know where he's really buried. They're deceivers. Possible? Possible. Likely? Mm-mm. Why? Because pain has a way of flushing out the truth. You know this. Just look at any, read something about law and plea bargains. There's always somebody in the pack who's like, I'll take the plea. I'll take the lighter sentence. I'll take less pain. I'll take some bonus that some benefit that you're going to give me. I'll take, here's the truth, here's the truth, here's the truth. The truth always comes out. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when, especially as the circle gets bigger and bigger, and because there's more people who could say, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to fess up, especially when the Romans were getting the scourges out and saying, all right, you're next. When they were chaining the Christians up to poles, stakes in the ground and lighting their feet on fire and saying, okay, you're next. Especially when they're laying out crosses like their Lord and said, okay, you're going on this one next. I'm telling you, at some point, pain would have caused at least one or two or three of them to crack and say, okay, you know, just kidding. I just remembered he's not really alive after all. But that's not what happened. And that's what makes history so fascinating, is that you have Christian upon Christian upon Christian who did go to the death, painful deaths, and they never changed their story. They're like, oh, no, no, we've seen him. So that's why even though the way I'm going out isn't the way I wanted to go out, but I know because he lives, I will live as well. So I can't change my story. He's alive. And that was the whole reason that the Christians had to die, because they kept saying, no, no, Jesus is Lord, and he's alive. So C.S. Lewis would observe, many people, they'll choose to die for something they believe is true. And you know that's true. Take Islamic extremists who fly into buildings in New York City. Take kamikaze pilots who crashed their airplanes in World War II. It's not hard to find people who choose to die for something they believe is true. But C.S. Lewis pointed out, nobody will willingly die for something they know is false. At some point, most people say, actually, not going to go to the death for that because I know it's not true, which means if they weren't deceived, and if they weren't deceivers, you only have one more choice. They were right. He really did rise from the dead. Thomas really did touch the holes
in his body and say, my Lord and my God. Why? Because honest doubts, they don't drift forever. They lead somewhere. And Thomas followed the thread to his own conclusion. After admitting the doubts, after investigating, he followed the thread to belief. So my question to you is, where are you and where's your thread in the journey of faith right now, yourself? Some of you, you're here today and you have real doubts. Maybe you've never said them out loud, but I'd encourage you to admit those. It's not weakness, it's the beginning, actually, of something real. And the wonderful thing about the Christian faith is that it is robust, it is hearty. It is not a wispy, thin, little fragile thing. No, there is a skeletal structure underneath it that is sound-minded, just as Blaise Pascal. So in closing, I'll give you a challenge that Pascal would give to his mathematical and scientific friends. Once he'd awakened their curiosities and at least got them to say, okay, maybe, I'm not saying I'm a believer, but I'm saying maybe. He'd say, okay, then I want to challenge you to take us one step further. Why don't you engage yourself in a 30-day experiment? For 30 days, why don't you give the benefit of the doubt to God, not against? For 30 days, why don't you just lean in? Because we talk about the Christian faith, not Christian proof. We can't prove anything beyond a shadow of a doubt, but the atheist can't either. So finally, there is some faith. Are you putting your faith in God or against God? He said, why don't you flip the coin over, and for 30 days, why don't you just try faith on for size? Hang out with some believers. Join a small group. Sign up on the, hang out with some Christians. Listen to them. Talk with them. Hear their stories. Read the Bible. Actually, take the Gospel of John, the one that we looked at here today with Thomas. And you can read that in 3 weeks if you just take a chapter a day. Just say, I'll read chapter one today. I'll read chapter. Just go through the Gospel of John. Start to read the Bible. But don't read the Bible and what's going on there while you're rolling your eyes. Oh, this is so dumb. No, actually lean in and say, okay, I'm just daring to believe actually that this is historical. And then even dare to pray, talk to him. But again, not eye-rollingly, but seriously saying, okay, I don't know if I really, really, really believe this, but I'm stepping out. God, I'm gonna talk to you, not with cynicism, yes, with skepticism, but I'm going to dare to believe you are out there and that you care enough about me to listen to my prayers. Pascal would say, you try this for 30 days and you see what happens in your own life. Because in the same way that Jesus stepped in to meet Thomas, he'll step in to meet you as well. And that's what happened to my friend Frank. Oh, it took a bit more than 30 days. He was a crusty thing. And he loved... Oh, he'd bring out zingers. What do you say about this one? And he'd tell me, I got you now, you know. And so we'd have these talks. And I had to bring Pastor Dan in and say, Pastor Dan, you got to help me. This guy's wearing me out, you know. And but the day finally came when he said, I've run out of objections. I've become a believer. I believe that it's true for everybody, and that means it's true for me too. And that was a day of rejoicing. We baptized him and I held him under the water extra long. Man, we got a lot to cleanse you, but you know, we got him baptized and there was celebration and then a year and a half ago, we gathered and celebrated again as his body, which was cancer-ridden, finally gave out. And we grieved then and we grieve now because we miss them. But we grieve not as those who have no hope, but we grieve as those who are full of hope. Because we know that Frank had come to an awareness of what Paul said, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Now, my question to you is, where are you in your journey? My hope is that if you are a skeptic, you'll at least think about the things that we've talked about, and that you'd at least take a step in and say, I'll engage in this 30-day experiment. I'll hang out with some Christians. I'll actually take them seriously. I'll actually read the Gospel of John. I'll actually pray. And then let's see what God does in the next 30 days. I think he'll do something, because I've just seen it happen too many times not to believe it. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this fascinating story of Thomas and the grace that you showed to him, meeting him where he needed you to meet him so that he could really believe. Now, my prayer, Lord, is for anyone who's here who says, you know, I think it might be time for me to take seriously. I can't just flippantly, cynically, eye-rollingly dismiss all this. I need to engage my mind. And so my prayer is, Lord, that in the coming days, you would meet with people at every point in their journey, wherever they are, and that you'd lead them closer to you and into a saving relationship with you. And I pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.